Chandler is a physics professor at Baylor. He went to Valparaiso University in the Midwest in Indiana, I think. And then went off to Caltech, where he got a PhD, and came back with his character not corrupted. And I'm talking about California, not Caltech. and has been teaching here. And we're glad for him to be able to kind of share with us first. He's a lovely university. He's a very distinguished scientist whose work is in string theory. And obviously, part of that is his interest in the local universe. So, Gerald Cohn will have to tell us why you think we should read the main universes and how that enlarges our view of God rather than supports Hawking and others who would probably like it for a different reason. Okay?
Okay. Thank you. Thank you again for this opportunity. We'll get this on. Get it on. Okay, yes, I'm going to give a talk in support of the possibility, and I'll emphasize possibility. There is no absolute proof, but I think from the view of string and M theorists, there is growing evidence suggesting the existence of the multiverse. So I do have a question mark in my title. The multiverse, next step in the growing understanding of reality. And to understand the whole of reality has been the pursuit, or one of the pursuits, of humankind since the appearance of our species. Over the last few thousand years, the human perception of physical reality has been transformed through discrete steps. Each paradigm advancement has presented a larger, more grand creation, a fuller representation of God's eternal power. And now, the beginning of the new millennium, I believe, may well denote the commencement of another profound advancement of humankind's perception of the whole of existence, and thus of the creative nature of God. And I think this new paradigm shift, if true, is of far greater magnitude and vastly more comprehensive than all of the preceding. And in this plenary session, I'm going to summarize the past perceptions of physical reality quickly, and then focus on the scientific and mathematical evidence suggesting a new multiverse paradigm from string M theory. And in particular, I am, again, emphasizing what I'm talking about, and I'll be presenting in our session later, is multiverse from string M theory. There's a general concept of multiverse, and there's string derived with more constraints. And I'm emphasizing the string derived. M theory from the string derived paints a vast, expanded picture of reality. Its beauty, order, simplicity, and complexity are, to me, as a string theorist and a Christian, incomparable. And then in the first talk of the multiverse session, I'm going to consider some of the philosophical and theological issues raised by the concept of a string theory multiverse. And we'll have several additional issues and insights raised by other talks, both pro and con, multiverse. And we'll get off to start with one of the earliest views of reality, and that was the ancient Mideast worldview of the three-story universe, the one that basically is what's presented and seen in the writing of the times of Genesis and the early books. And that is by three tier. You had the mid-layer, Earth, floating on the underworld, primeval ocean, pillars of the Earth supporting it. And then we have the firmament of the heavens, or the triple layer, the firmament of the heavens. This was eventually replaced by the geocentric picture of the universe from Greco-Roman, longest-lasting view of any. Lasted until about the 1600s. Earth was the center. The sun and all the other planets orbited the Earth itself. Then around the 1700s, there was growing, overwhelming, eventually evidence of a heliocentric picture of the universe. This lasted, for about a century and a half, 1600s through much of the 1700s, and eventually replaced by a growing understanding that there was more than just our solar system. And I'll call this new picture the galactocentric picture of the universe. Lasted from the 1800s through the early 1900s, even through the age of most of the early years of Einstein's relativity. Until around 1924, people such as Edwin Hubble showed that what were thought to be gaseous nebula within our own galaxy were actually distant galaxies in themselves. And so a whole collection of galaxies were found, just as like the Milky Way. Pretty soon is also, and so this took us one step further to the stage or the paradigm we've been in most of last century and some of the beginning century now. And that is what I'll call the universe-centric picture of the universe. And here, this is a computer simulation where each dot itself represents an entire galaxy. Or adding more a 3D effect, this. the visible universe, about 14 billion light years in diameter, not cubed, but just to emphasize 3D effect, which corresponds to about 8 to the 10 to the 22 miles. Current size is actually double this, since these were objects seen at least 14 billion years ago. They've had 14 billion years to travel near speed of light. It's about double then. And again, in here, now in the visible universe, we have a trillion galaxies, half trillion to a trillion, and a half trillion to a trillion stars per galaxy. Visible universe. And what's more, the universe is expanding. Again, from the first evidence came from Hubble, from Ed Hubble. He showed that, and that the further away a galaxy was, the faster it seemed to be moving away from ours. And again, we can think of this expansion by picturing the universe, if we drop one dimension, much like a balloon that's being blown up, a spherical balloon. We put dots on it. Each dot is like individual galaxies. You're blowing up the balloon itself, the surface. The more separation there initially is between galaxies, the more the expansion is between them over a given unit of time. So the further away two galaxies are, the faster they are speeding away from each other. And then this is just a two-dimensional picture of the three-dimensional effect. And the universe-centric paradigm naturally raised the question of how came the universe. The Big Bang answer was eventually seen and eventually fleshed out to include the initial superluminal inflation stage. And then in 1997, it was actually discovered, as we'll remember, that the universe is now in a second acceleration stage, but much longer, much weaker than the initial inflation stage. And the best fit to data indicates that this new inflationary stage, or accelerating stage, began about 6 to 7 billion years ago. And then the question quickly became, what would make the universe accelerate? Best answer was dark energy, a form of energy that exists even in empty space, but acts as an anti-gravitational effect. It's smoothly distributed through the galaxy, through space, doesn't fall into galaxies and clusters, it has a constant density, or near constant. There's very small limits on the amount of change that it could be undergoing, and it's invisible to ordinary matter, only detected via gravity. And we know now that the course of our universe, where it looks much like the red path, what we see, and I can't get this pointer working here. Look at the top of the red, those two omegas. Omega M is the critical percent of total mass of the universe, and the next one is the percent of dark energy. What's fit the known expansion rates of the universe is 30% of all mass energy in the universe is matter, combination of both visible and what's known as dark or hidden matter, and 70% of all mass energy in the universe is this dark energy that's causing the expansion. And it has produced, we're matching the path of 30%, 70% to the red line, which is the current map of the past, history, and future of the universe growth. So within the last decade, we've come across a complete inventory of the stuff of which the universe is made. 70% dark energy, 25% dark matter, 5 ordinary matter. And, you know, this has led to an astonishing idea. We know the composite, what the universe is composed of. We've also, now, we're fairly knowledgeable about the history of the universe, starting from the very, very early on to current stage and the predicted acceleration. We have a good map, good understanding of the entire 13.7 billion year history. And it leads to a very rough and continually more refined timeline. So in the 50s, it began a drive to understand the forces of nature within the universe in a consistent, hopefully related manner, which this culminated in the 1960s and 70s with the standard model of particle interactions, which determined the forces, the fundamental forces besides gravity. The strong nuclear force, SU3, the weak and electromagnetic forces, SU2 cross U1, gave us a quantum mechanical description of the strong, weak, and nuclear and electromagnetics. So we can even go back now, a timeline, the physics, what happened in the universe very, very early on. As early back, knowing what happened with the distinct forces, how they likely unified, merged with gravity, until we get back to a very, very early time of about 10 to the minus 42 seconds after creation of the universe. That point, up until now, this is where quantum mechanics and gravity, when we try to combine them, has not made sense. If we try to work at that stage, we get computational nonsense, probabilities of interactions giving us probabilities of, minus 10,470, things that don't make any sense at all. Until basically the goal of finding some mathematical structure that could answer all of these questions. And along with that, whatever was proposed and worked on, that being string theory, had to answer the problem with the dark energy. We've measured the dark energy, but surprisingly, it turned out not to be enough to even come close to matching the theoretical predictions. Knowing the standard model forces, based on that, the value that should have been found for dark energy should have been 10 to the 120 times what was observed. Greatest disconnect between theory and experiment in the universe. Literally. Yeah. Now, we can manage, if we assume supersymmetry in a form that's broken along the electroweak scale, we can touch this up a bit. The variation now is just that it's off by a factor of 10 to the 60. Still not too good. So whatever we propose as a grand unified theory, theory of everything, has to explain this dark energy. This has been one of the major issues stressed in string and M theory itself. That's why I'm emphasizing this. And really, standard model quantum mechanics can in no way answer that question right now. Why this disparity? So basically, in the course of the 20th century, we went from knowing almost nothing about the universe to knowing all of its basic features. But as that last slide presents, knowing is not understanding. We know what is, but there's been no real understanding of it. And so, again, we've known a great deal. General relativity, standard model particle physics. We know the inventory of all the matter that there is. But before string and M theory, deep puzzles have remained. How do we reconcile gravity with quantum mechanics? If we could do that, we should be able to explain the dark energy value. Why this dark matter? Why the amount that there is? In fact, why of the 30% mass energy of the universe, why is 27% of the total 30 dark matter? Why is only 3% the standard baryonic matter? There was an attempt, string and M theory became an attempt to look, finding a big idea to tie the things together. And again, this has led to string and now M theory as a possible theory of everything. And I think when we say that, we actually need, when we consider the spiritual, we should actually say theory of everything physical, not theory of everything. Tope rather than toe. And so this is the field that I've been working and several hundred other people trying to find an answer to this. And again, in 1980s, string theory was offered as a means of consistently unifying the non-gravitational forces with gravity, the sole additional force found in our universe. And string theory enlarged the universe-centric paradigm, and is in the process of, I think, from a universe of 3 plus 1 dimensions, 3 spatial dimensions, and 1 time, to one of 9 plus 1 dimensions, 9 spatial dimensions, and only 1 time. And so it did so, it unified everything that, by saying that all forces in nature, the force-carrying particles, the gluons, gravitons, the W and Zs of the weak nuclear, and the photons of electromagnetics, and the fundamental particles, which can basically be described as 3 generations of quarks, the particles which form protons and neutrons and other baryons, and the electrons and neutrinos in 3 generations. Now, in string theory, all of those can be represented by, I don't know if we can see it here, by a single, very, very tiny closed string of what we call compactified energy with a radius scale, and therefore circumference, 10 to the minus 33 centimeters. What's that compared to? That's still 10 to the minus 20th times smaller than the nucleus of an atom itself. What's unique about string theory, and this is where, again, where the name comes along, is all of the prior thought or viewed fundamental particles actually correspond to vibration modes, i.e. notes played on this string of energy. Much like notes are a product of a violin string. The violin string is the fundamental object. Notes are the effect. The string is fundamental. Particles are the effect. And the 6 extra dimensions of string theory, again, I said string theory says it's 9 spatial, not 3, were said to be compact, very small and closed, as I said. And again, with 10 to the minus 33 centimeters in size. And the whole story of the universe was shown to be much more complex than we had realized prior. But nevertheless, the enlargement of 3 spatial dimensions into 9 spatial was still consistent with a single universe-centric paradigm. It's only until we've gone to the next, into the M theory stage, where we're actually going, I think, into the possibility of that we need to consider the multiverse. String theory still kept us in one universe. When we advanced very shortly into M theory, as I'll show how, that's when we take the leap into the possibility of a multiverse. and again, came out of string theory with those extra six dimensions. They had to be compactified. But you can compactify six directions into a large range of shapes. The simplest would be a six-dimensional sphere or a six-dimensional toroid. I just have two dimensions there. It's hard for any of us to picture anything beyond three spatial. But what it turned out is the shape that's necessary to produce the physics, both the forces and the particles that we have, is a shape, a six-dimensional shape called a Calabi-Yau. And this is just a two-dimensional portrait of a Calabi-Yau. It has peaks and holes and valleys and all that. But this is what was shown. The Calabi-Yau had been, shapes had been investigated by mathematicians, Calabi and Yau, in the 50s and 60s. They didn't know, there was no real use for it, though, until some string theorists realized that those shapes happened to have the properties needed to reproduce the forces that we know of and the particles. But there's a great variety of these things. Of the simplest form of the Calabi-Yaus, there happens to be around a number of about 10 to the 12 possibilities. And each of those, the exact shape determines exactly what the particles in nature are and the forces besides gravity. Gravity doesn't need any compactified shape, but all the other forces do. So you change the shape a little bit, and you've changed the physics of an entire universe. And so, again, one of the questions then, can the extra dimensions help with dark energy? And the answer is maybe, because when you change the shape, the constants of nature no longer constant. They are variables dependent upon the shape of the compactified dimensions. And so, again, in each of these 10 to 12 compactifications, the values of the cosmological constant will likely be different. And not just that, but everything changes. The forces, the particles, the properties, the fundamental constants change with the shape. Let's see, I'm going to skip that. I'm running short on time. But soon after, you know, there were many advantages seen to string theory, such as it was unifying the forces and all of that. But there was a fundamental problem for about a decade. Because soon after what became known as the string revolution in 1984, which showed that string theory was a consistent 9 plus 1 dimensional quantum theory, and string was offered as a theory of everything, there actually appeared very quickly not just one string theory, but correctly five. In each of these five, the fundamental string had slightly different properties, which posed a problem. They were given names, and I'm not going to go over them, but if you're trying to propose a theory of everything, that's good. Five isn't. What do you choose from one? What makes one of those five better? And that was a real question for 10 years. And these were the five. It was a nagging problem for the first decade of string theory. But eventually, what was known as the second string revolution of 94-95 resolved this pivotal issue by showing that all five apparently distinct theories were in fact equivalent, and that they were simply different mathematical expressions of the same underlying theory. What I like to think about this is, and there was a process where you can transform the mathematics from one to the other and show that they were all the same. How I try to think of it is each theory was like, and the five different theories were like five books. The same book written in five different languages, though. Unless you had some type of Rosetta Stone, you wouldn't realize that you were reading the same book in five different languages. But the Rosetta Stone was what was discovered around 94, 95. And that was that there was actually one more model, and that was like the translation. And that was called M-theory. And what it showed was that the string itself was likely not the correct view of everything. I have one of those around here, if I can find it. Oh, here it is. That actually, it wasn't the string as the fundamental particle, but the string actually had some thickness. It was more like the donut. We now think that this is the fundamental. Mathematically speaking, this is a torus. It's now believed that the torus is the shape of the fundamental particle. And if you shrink it down in different ways and eliminate the thickness to it, you can get all of those five theories in mathematically equivalent. So this is a two-dimensional surface. In general, it's called a membrane. And membrane theory is a little long, so it was shortened to M theory. That's why we now talk about M theory rather than string theory. And we've gone from 10, total 9 plus 1 spatial dimensions, to 10 plus 1. And then the membrane is the fundamental thing. And that brought along with it some of the simplest models possible. When we go from the membrane theory, string to membrane theory, that's where we have the real jump from the possibility of likely staying in the universe-centric picture to the strong possibility of a multiverse-centric, or multiverse. Because the simplest models in M-theory suggest two different surfaces, one of which our universe exists on. And these surfaces are called brains now. We have the observable brain that we live on, and at least one more hidden brain. The laws of physics are different between these two brains, except for gravity. Gravity can be exchanged between these two brains, but nothing else. And the forces of nature are generally different from between the one we live on and the hidden brain. And this provided instantly a good understanding of dark matter, because dark matter is matter that only interacts gravitationally with our observable matter. We know dark matter exists. The galaxies would not be stable without it, without all galaxies being surrounded with a different density. The blue here represents the maximum density of dark matter around a spiral galaxy like us, like Milky Way, with our sun denoted where it is. And that dark matter has to exist. It's been known and suspected to exist for decades, but there's no real rational understanding of what it was. In string theory, we believe this is the matter that exists over in the hidden brain. It interacts with observable matter gravitationally, and is shifted along this new direction that came out of M-theory. Very, very short distance. Real experiments are going on to determine what this distance is. One of the leaders in that is University of Washington, Seattle, and they've shown that the furthest distance, the separation between the brain our universe exists in and the hidden brain, is no more than a tenth of a millimeter. University of Colorado and Stanford are now trying to do some more refined experiments to try to check limitations down to a nanometer. Rumor is out about Stanford results are leaking, but they don't have anything definite yet. Their results are supposed to come out within a few months officially. And again, I'll skip over that. Basically, where we get to, as I'm running out of time here, is how does M-theory provide a multiverse? And the issue comes out under the assumption that the brains can move, either the two edge ones, one of which is our universe and the hidden one, or in the more complicated models, you can have brains between them. And again, the brains are 9 plus 1 dimensional objects initially, and we can have some moving in between. And what's become known as what's called the ekpyrotic or out of fire universes is when our brain with one of the other ones may collide as they get near each other. And surprisingly, very short distance, no further away than a tenth of a millimeter, these things are heavy, these brains, very slow. The mathematical computation for the collision rate, even if they're no further apart than a submillimeter, is about one collision per 100 billion to trillion years. But when they do collide, when they're far enough away from each other, they are flat in the nine spatial dimensions. As they approach each other, they're going to get bumpy. And colliding brains would not remain perfectly flat as they approach each other due to quantum fluctuations. And the big bangs are going to occur in bumps on brains when they first collide. That means there's going to be multiple, vast number of separated big bang regions that would likely have formed from distinct collision points in the brains. And this is where the suggestion and likelihood of existence of a multiverse comes from M-theory. That the explanation for our universe is that our observable brain and a moving one collided 13.7 billion years ago. If that is true, then it was not just a single collision that formed our Big Bang and our universe, but a vast number. And so this is where M-theory now naturally provides likelihood of a multiverse. You had a Big Bang where each Planck fluctuation point collided as the brains collided. Each one would then, and in these nine-dimensional surfaces colliding, various numbers of dimensions would compactify in each Big Bang collision in various shapes. And that's saying that now the physics in each Big Bang universe that was created 13.7 billion years ago are uncorrelated, vastly differing, dependent upon the shape of how the universe, of how the compact dimensions, and even the number that compactified, how they compactified, both shape and number, produce a vast number of differing universes, not universes parallel with same forces, you know, and alternate histories or something, but in these multiverses, we're talking about a set of universes with vastly differing physics. It's not one where there's likely not a parallel one where we're all here, but the walls are green. But instead, it's differing ones where the laws of physics are vastly different. And so this is the type of of multiverse I'll be talking about from string derived. Vast number. And if the brains are large enough in the extra dimensions, or in our visible directions, then the number of brains, a number of universes that would be created could be incredibly large. And so in string theory and M theory, we have the possibility of all the theoretical universes that could exist in some multidimensional plane versus along the vertical, the cosmological constant or dark energy of those universes. And from distribution of the types of models that or universes that can come out, much like a mountain range. It's called the string landscape, and where we see basically like mountain ranges, you pick a particular point at a particular altitude, and that will correspond to a particular universe with the corresponding cosmological constant or dark energy. And we measure it in units of one, in units of reduced Planck mass to the fourth. Interesting thing is, if you do that and you measure the cosmological constant, as I was saying, the predicted value would be of a universe would be order one. Ours instead ends up being, at 10 to the minus 120, barely off bottom of zero cosmological constant. One of the issues now in string theory is saying, why is our universe there? That's very, very improbable compared to the whole string landscape. And if in each collision of a brain, of two brains, there's a vast array of universes chosen from that string landscape, that is, they're realized from the string landscape, why ours right down there? So one of the issues that has become very important in string theory is the somehow realization of or understanding of a cosmic anthropic principle is the way one group is approaching it. There's other approaches too. And one thing I want to clarify, how did this vast number come about? I said from string theory there's likely about 10 to the 12th models. But then the variations that you get when you go to M theory and have an extra dimension, you can have extra fields wrapped around the string called fluxes, and these add this large factor of 10 to the 10 to 10 to the 100, which oftentimes we simply average and say, average exponentially and say 10 to the 500 or so. So we know at minimum, we say in the string landscape there's about 10 to the 500 different string universes possible. And a vast number of those are probably realized each time there's a collision between brains. It's also, there's not just the positive cosmological constant stuff, which ours is now. It's our cosmological constant, or dark energy, is plus 10 to the minus 120. You can actually go, there's actually what are known as anti-de Sitter universes possible with negative cosmological constant. And positive cosmological constant are universes that are expanding. Anti-de Sitter ones are ones that are going to be compactifying. But this whole range is possible. And the interesting thing that's come out, I'll talk about more later this afternoon, is the vacuum of an M theory is actually an anti-de Sitter space one. You start way down here at near close to minus one, and then what M theory does is predict a whole set in a given vacuum, a given set of compactified shape. You have a whole set starting at minus one and going up and then jumping in units of energy density of no more than 10 to the minus 120 in Planck to the fourth units. So they're very narrow gaps. And that's one reason why, also again, evidence for the multiverse from string theory is that you don't just have the potential for a single universe, even for a single compact shape, but you have a whole series that starts at minus one and goes all the way up to one. And ours is in the positive range, right up above zero at 10 to the minus 120. Let's see. And with all this, what we get out of M theory is that M theory implies the existence, implies the likelihood of the existence of a multiverse that contains at least 10 to the 100 to 10 to the 1,000, and as I said, often average to 10 to the 500 universes within. Each universe is brought about by its own Big Bang / inflation process and may contain vastly differing physical laws. And the near countless possibilities for universes is known then as the string/M landscape, the theoretical stuff. It's realized, at least at a given time, a vast number of these are realized, produced through brain collisions. and a significant percent of these universes may provide for something similar to carbon-based life forms like us, some factor of about 10 to the minus 9 per total may be producible for carbon-based life forms. Others could provide for vastly different life forms, and the vast majority may not allow for any life forms whatsoever. And I'm going to go into more detail about that and those figures this afternoon. In the multiverse of M-theory, vast numbers of universes, again, are likely created simultaneously. Creation of universes within the M-theory multiverse may also be unending, with creation cycles of new universes predicted by what's known as the ekpyrotic M-theory models, where the brains may be oscillatory. And I'll get into that. This is some research that's being done, whether the brains oscillate, collide, exchange energy each time, or whether once they collide, that's it. Two brains have gone into one, and so there's only so many possible collisions cycles possible depending upon the total number that you have. And with that, again, the interesting aspect is, by coincidence, the lifetime of a universe generally corresponds to the same scale as the collision rate between brains. Everything happens on the lifetimes of hundreds of billions to trillions of years. And in closing, we're at the stage where we may be reaching the next step in our perception of reality. We may be undergoing the paradigm shift from a universe-centric to a multiverse-centric picture. If this is true, then M-theory and the M-theory universe provides a much deeper understanding of the whole story of creation with a simplicity, order, beauty, and complexity creation that we've never imagined before. And I stop there.
This was field tested just before the talk, so hopefully it'll work. Thanks, Gerald, for a very interesting presentation of the state of the art in string theory, much of which I agree with, except for the multiverse part. So I'm going to try to do what Jesus said, do good to those that calculate against you. So what I think I'll need to do is reboot this thing, unfortunately. So the general perspective I have on the multiverse is not positive, as Walter announced. My own view is this is, despite what was said before, not a good direction for science to move in, and I think one that is not theologically positive, by which I mean to the extent that it is, it may prove to be accepted as a scientific paradigm. It will, I think, cause an enormous theological paradigm shift. Now, that is not necessarily a bad thing, but it also, I think, we should not be sanguine and just say, well, there's a multiverse, God created the multiverse, everybody's happy, let's go home. In fact, this is, I think, quite a profound shift, one that requires both a lot of thought and a serious critique. And what I would say is that believing... I'm not sure why this isn't booting up here. Believing in a theory of... now we're in good shape. Okay. A theory of everything is quite a different story from what the multiverse is asking that we do. And so... in this, if just give me a moment here to get this in. So in this story of the multiverse, I think we need to seriously think about what we are being asked to accept as scientists, and for those of us that are believers, which I expect is the vast majority of this group, how it is probably going to make us rethink our concepts about God. And I do not regard it as guaranteed positive, or as guaranteed that this is going to work out positively. And on this point, I differ from Gerald. So let's just pull this over a bit. Slideshow. There we go. Okay, so you can all see that. So my point is that we're here exploring God's world of endless wonder, but that's not necessarily the same thing as exploring the wonder of God's endless world, and it's the endless world that I have trouble with. So, as I was trying to say in the preamble while waiting for the machine, a theory of everything is not the same as a theory of anything. Theologically, a God who can do anything is not the same as a God that does everything. What do I mean by that? Well, a theory of everything is a reductionist description of all that physically does and might exist. A God who can do anything is a creator capable of instantiating any self-consistent reality, like this one. But a theory of anything is a reductionist assertion that all that might exist actually does exist. This is a very different statement. Likewise, a God that does everything is an agent that instantiates every self-consistent reality. Again, a very different statement, and I think this needs to be kept in mind. So, I'm not against the first, and to the extent that string theory may be a theory of everything, I'm happy about it, and one could have old-fashioned theological debates, but to give you the bottom line, I'm not real keen about the second, and I'll tell you why. It emerges out of the subject of cosmic theology, and you saw this picture. Cosmic theology deals with three things: injection, direction, and selection. And we can ask, is our universe typical in terms of how it got started, the injection, where it is going at its development, the direction, and the structures like us and other life forms and planets and all that stuff that emerges, the selection. And what we have discovered over the last 5 decades is that our universe obeys special laws of physics. The structures we see now are not typical, they are special. And we got started with unusual or special initial conditions. In other words, our universe, compared to all the kinds we can think of, and you saw some of this in Gerald's talk about 10 to the minus 120, doesn't look typical. So we can only live in a universe whose laws, structure, and initial conditions permit our kind of life. This is a weak anthropic principle. It's obvious. Fish gotta swim, birds gotta fly. fish could only discover a universe with water around them. They can't live anywhere else. So we can only discover a universe that's hospitable to our kind of life. That's easy. That's obvious. What's not obvious is these conditions are special, that life needs special permission to exist. In other words, the life-friendly or biophilic parameter range is narrow, not broad. Out of all the kinds of parameters we can imagine for all of these things, life exists in a tiny, narrow range. This is not obvious. It was not known 5 decades and more ago. I regard it as a scientific discovery accumulated over a variety of lines of evidence. So I would contend, and I think very few people would disagree with this now, our universe is not typical. It's not a garden variety universe. Why? Well, this is related to a puzzle of potentiality. The standard paradigm in science is there's a lot of things that could happen, but one thing does. Physics, I would contend, is its job is to describe both the actual system, the actuality, and the things a system might do, the things it could do. It does not mean that all the possible things are actually materially existing things. This is an important distinction in my view. What's actualized depends on the underlying laws, the symmetries, the dynamics, the SU3 cross SU2 cross U1, etc., the structure of a crystal in condensed matter physics, and the boundary conditions that are set either by an agent or an environment. So if we want to understand tennis, of course the path of the ball depends on the law of gravity, but it also depends on how the tennis player hit it, what the boundary conditions were. So in going from the potential to the actual, what we've learned in science is that systems seek out to get rid of as much energy as they can. They like to fall down hills. They like to maximize disorder. And they like to attain stability. And there's a sort of competition between these things. In the hydrogen atom, for example, all the chemists and physicists, and probably more than that, know that the hydrogen atom has a simple N equals 1 lowest energy ground state where the electron zips around spherically, but it has all kinds of excited states, infinitely many, and these are the orbital structures you see. But we don't say the reason why most hydrogen atoms are in their ground state is because all possible hydrogen atoms actually exist, and therefore we've got to see this one because all the others are there. There's the website where you can find these orbitals, by the way. So in other words, if we plot the potential energy, say, relative to some parameter of the hydrogen atom, the lowest energy state would be in that valley, and there would be other metastable states, higher energy that are stable, and the red dot represents an unstable state. All of these things can happen, but they don't have to happen in order for us to understand what nature is doing. Furthermore, the crucial role of agency in science is tacitly ignored, or rather I would say it's used as needed in setting up experiments, in making observations, and in applying the science of potentiality, which we know, all applied scientists and engineers know this, you turn potentiality into actuality via contrivances, or dare I say by an intelligent design. So when it comes to cosmology, we're up against a wall because we have these special conditions. In other words, we appear to be at the top of the hill and not a bottom of a valley based on a number of criteria, the most striking of which is this very tiny positive value of the cosmological constant. Well, why is that? Well, maybe it's just there. It is what it is. Well, I don't think anybody really likes that. I don't like that. It's a reasonless explanation for existence. So the good old-fashioned way of doing science is this should be the result of natural law. And we should be able to write the theory of the universe on a T-shirt, and it would be a single universe theory. And in other words, we're not at the top of the hill. We're mistaken. We're actually at the bottom of a valley due to laws that govern perhaps our dynamical evolution, certainly, and also our initial conditions, maybe. So this would make lots of scientists happy. But we can't seem to find that. Well, another possibility is agency. Probably everybody here likes that. So you can certainly stabilize something by putting a finger on top, right? You're going to be there because I want you to. And in some sense, secretly, maybe we believe this, I'm not sure, the problem a theoverse person has, and I count myself in this group to some extent, what is the causal link between intention and action? In the neuroscience talks we heard this morning, this same problem is there. How does intention become physical reality, physical instantiation? We do not know this at all. But my suspicion is that to the extent we can understand this for the human mind and maybe animal minds, it will give us some insight into the theological mind. But let's keep going. What if it's the result of statistics? In other words, maybe all of these different places are filled, all the valleys, all the tops of hills. So we're going to be, if everything happens, then obviously this strange we are here situation has to happen. And this is the idea of the multiverse. It's inevitable because everything is actualized. And furthermore, we want it, or at least some people want it, to be typical within observer-permitting universes. So the reason why this has happened is that there's a frustration with standard science. The natural law approach, let's find the law of nature that will show us where the unique ground state just isn't working. People have tried and tried and tried and tried, and at the moment the community sort of has given up. Osmotically, perhaps, but that's what happened. Well, theoverse people like to promote the idea that these special conditions are telling us something, but their opponents say, this is a science stopper. I have had someone tell me, Rob, if you believe in God, why would you do physics? What's the point? I'm not making this up. This happened to me from a colleague. So they don't like that. So what's left? Well, bottom-up evidence from cosmic fine-tuning and biophilic selection that I've mentioned briefly, and top-down mechanisms such as inflation and string theory that Jerry have mentioned, have caused people to consider this multiverse idea. And so we have to take it seriously, if only because my good friend Jerry is. But Jerry is not alone. Many people do have this perspective in the scientific community, and I don't think we can just laugh it off. So you can see from Scientific American, infinite Earths and parallel universes really exist. Well, do they? Everything means everything, doesn't it? In fact, it seems that perhaps everything means anything, and this is the danger. What are the issues people are concerned with in the multiverse? There are basically three. What's the framework? What principles guide the construction of a multiverse? Another is counting. What counts as a universe, and how do you count these things we call universes? How do you do that? And the third problem is typicality. What's a typical universe? How is it typical? Why is it typical? This is what people are actively doing in research. They're getting paid real money to do this, and your tax dollars are supporting it. Mine too, I guess, in Canada. So what's the framework? Well, let's consider a bathtub. Suppose I reached into a bathtub and pulled out a typical molecule of water. In fact, if it had dirt in it, if I'd just taken a bath, it'd have other stuff. A typical molecule would be water, and I would expect that all the allowed properties of liquid water molecules would be realized. It would probably have a velocity typical of those within the bathtub. If I randomly selected a molecule, I should expect it on a variety of metrics, the vibration of the states of the molecule, its speed, and all that stuff, should be average. Well, the multiverse idea is that our universe is like a water molecule in a big bathtub we call the multiverse. So here's the bathtub, and if we grabbed a typical universe out of it, or reached in and blindly grabbed, then we should find our universe should be typical within that context. In other words, a universe you grab should be typical. Why should ours be any different than an average universe? Since all allowed properties of universes are realized, it's got to be in there somewhere. Roughly speaking, this is the paradigmatic mentality. Well, what kind of multiverse? There are four kinds, as Max Tegmark pointed out. If you allow infinite space, infinite time, and arbitrarily large amounts of matter, you will realize all possible initial conditions. Every physical structure that could exist will exist. Another is all possible laws of physics. This is what string theory does. So each one of those little bubbles on that second diagram is one of those big things, and all those mini bubbles in there is an observable universe. Quantum mechanics has proposed many worlds for a long time. The idea is that every time a decision is made, if you can't read it, it said,
you know, this guy's asking this girl, you want to go out for a drink? Well, quantum mechanically, something happened in the brain in one universe. He says, why not? And you can see what happens. They get married and have kids. And the other says, forget this, you jerk. And then they never see each other again. Well, this happens. And then Tegmark has said, look, let's go the whole shooting match. All possible mathematical structures should be physically instantiated. Fractals and Cantor sets and you name it, it's out there somewhere. But even worse, you could have computer simulation. It's easier to simulate a reality, as anybody that has a teenager that plays video games know, than it is to actually physically make one. So advanced space aliens in the multiverse are probably manufacturing universes right, left, and center, and guess what? Probably we are. Even Tegmark doesn't like that idea. So these are the foibles of this idea. We have a set of what is observable. Then we have everything that does exist, and outside of that, everything that could exist but doesn't. And the problem is, a key problem in the framework, we don't know where this boundary is. So the multiverse idea is to get rid of those questions by saying that everything that could exist does. Let's get rid of these questions by saying all that is possible is all that exists, and all that is observable is a subset within that realm of possibilities. So here's the problematic framework. You can contend it's cured by that, but then you have another problem. I'm going to come along with theory A. And theory A says this. And my theory is one of ontological economy. I want to minimize the amount of stuff that can exist. But along comes somebody with theory B, and they want to maximize potentiality. Which is better? Is it better to be parsimonious and say the least amount of stuff that can exist does? Or is it better to enlarge your view and say, I want as much stuff to exist as I can? I do not see how we can decide this, because remember, all the observable stuff is way in here. We do not, in principle, have the ability to access this, at least in any direct way. And this is a big problem with these kinds of theories. What counts and how? Problem number two. Well, within the context of many of these theories, you have some unstable state called a false vacuum that, because of gravity, expands exponentially. It's anti-gravitating, and it doubles in size very frequently. But you can have little bubbles appear in it of all different kinds. The different colors symbolize lower energy states, truer vacua. The green one is our vacua. Green means life, so we live there. All different shapes, all different sizes. And the idea is these are universes, sometimes called pocket universes, within this larger background multiverse structure. The whole thing is the multiverse. Cosmic inflation does give a mathematical picture that realizes this. The idea is the universe begins at a false vacuum. This generates a period of rapid exponential expansion in which the universe doubles in size every 10 to the minus 34 seconds. And what this does that cosmologists like is it turns bumpy, wiggly things into nice, smooth things. And so the problem of the speciality of injection, the special initial conditions, is smoothed out and goes away. So over time, what happens is you have this false vacuum, and you can have a bubble of true vacuum in it, and here's a different bubble, and there's a Big Bang. And here's a different kind of vacuum, and there's another one, and our Big Bang would be the life-friendly one, the green one. Of course, you have to create the false vacuum out of nothing, but it's so far away, who cares? The idea in this picture that many are promoting, Alex Vilenkin amongst others, is that there are infinitely many universes eternally nucleating from the false vacuum of the multiverse. It goes on and on forever and ever and ever. Well, how do you measure these things? This is a problem. One of the key problems is faster expanding universes should count more. A bigger universe moving faster takes up more space. Surely that's more likely than a little guy. But this leads to something called the youngness paradox, because the false vacuum expands the fastest. So even though a guy created earlier gets bigger, it produces, if you wait a little longer, the false vacuum produces even more baby universes, and so they overwhelm the little one. It's a bit like saying that a gorilla is big and powerful, but if you wait long enough, it'll be attacked by mosquitoes. And they're tiny, but they win. And you can and you might say, well, this is a trivial problem, but it has been estimated that under this picture, the probability that our 13.7 billion-year-old universe exists relative to the probability our universe in this picture were 13 billion years is a factor of 10 to the minus 60 difference. In other words, it's 10 to the 60 times more likely our universe is 700,000 years younger, 700 million years younger. Okay, that's a problem. Another is that of counting observers. A Copernican-type principle should suggest they should all be treated equally. In fact, Don Page has suggested that every conscious perception of all observers, all time, everywhere, should all be counted democratically. But the problem with this is you have something called a Boltzmann brain. In other words, a freak observer that quantum fluctuates or thermally fluctuates out of a vacuum can happen now and then. In a state of equilibrium, like the gas in this room, not a whole lot happens. But if we waited 10 to the 60 years, a brain would appear out of nowhere and think, hey, man, what's happening? I see a church. Well, that was fun. Now, you might think, well, this is nutso. There's lots more of us than those brains, and that's true. But guess what? We all die. The brains don't. So since the false vacuum expands exponentially, it is exponentially more likely if you wait long enough, remember you can wait forever, for these brains to appear. Even in our own accelerating universe, this is a big problem. Why are we biological brains instead of popped out of nowhere Boltzmann brains? The theory says the latter are more likely. It's easier. So here's high entropy, here's low entropy for the Boltzmann brain, but even lower entropy for our actual observable universe that has biological creatures in it like us. What's typical? Third problem, are we? Well, here's all kinds of observers, aliens in all different places in the biophilic parts of the multiverse. Let's pick one at random. If this person is typical, we should expect them to fall within the norm of a statistical distribution, much in the same way that if you left church Sunday morning, the first person you see on the street should be between, or first man, not woman, be a bit different, should be between 1.63 and 1.9 meters tall, right? That's the average, should be, that's the most likely thing you'd see. So if we're randomly selected from the multiverse, if we looked at a neutrino, if we picked a random particle like a neutrino, it should have an average neutrino mass within some distribution. So the promoters of typicality in the multiverse suggest a strategy of mediocrity. Consider all the constants of nature that don't have much to do with life, like the mass of the neutrino or the top quark mass or the charm quark mass or the gluon, muons and so on. If these fall within the mean of a normal distribution, then they would regard that as evidence for a multiverse. So, okay, there's some biologically special things, but of the things that don't seem to care about biology, if they fall within a statistical norm, they would regard that as evidence for a multiverse. Should we? Well, I leave that as an open question. But Jim Hartle and Mark Srednicki addressed this. There's trouble with typicality. We use Bayes' theorem implicitly in physics and sometimes in practice to figure out what theory is right. What we want to know is, given some data, what's the probability a theory is correct, right? You make an observation, we want to know what's the right theory. But in practice, the way we have to do this, at least in physics, is we propose hypotheses and then calculate or work out what the expected observations, what the expected data should be. So what we do is we have a bunch of theories, work out their consequences, and then we use Bayes' theorem, taking the probability that the data is seen given the theory to figure out the probability that once the observations are made, what is the theory? This goes on all the time. For example, here's three theories. One, theory number two, predicts there's only a pentagon. The other predicts either a pentagon or a diamond. And the third one says everything. And suppose these are the probabilities. Theory 1 says 50-50 chance of diamond pentagon. Theory 2 says the only thing you're going to see is a pentagon. And the other guy says no chance of a pentagon, but you have some probability of the others. Well, from Bayes' theorem, you can do this calculation, and these are the probabilities. You've got a 33% chance theory 1 is through, a 66% chance theory 2 is through, and you have falsified theory number 3. It predicted something that is wrong, that disagrees with observation. This is very nice in the way we like to think about science. In practice, it's usually a bit more complicated. Sometimes there's a tiny chance something is true and the others aren't, in which case this has a very tiny chance of being correct. The others are still almost their original values. So all of this is fine, but as Hartle and Srednickier point out, when it comes to the multiverse, in fact in science in general, but in particular in the multiverse, you have theoretical priors. Not only do you have the first things, you have this thing that I've colored in strawberry, as it turns out. What is the chance the theory is correct? What is the prior probability you believe in the theory? This isn't guided by observation. It tends to rely more on considerations of aesthetics or some other theoretical prejudice, mathematical simplicity. So suppose we want to know which observer is typical. Suppose we have humans and Jovians. You might have a theory which says there's a theory of life and there could be humans, there could be Jovians. There should be a lot more Jovians because Jupiter is big and Earth is small. So you might reason like this. Well, I find myself to be human, so I should weight the data by the probability that I'm human, namely take the total number of humans and divide by the total number of human plus Jovian. The Jovians are stand-in for Boltzmann brains, by the way. So if I want to know, my data includes the fact that I am human. What is the probability a given theory is correct given that I am human is what I want to know. But in order to know that, I've got to weight it by the probability that I observe myself to be human. So the reasoning goes. So let's take a simple model. Suppose there are either no Jovians or the number is proportional to the number of humans. Well, it's easy to do this arithmetic, just add up over j is 0 and j is alpha h, and you obtain this result. But if alpha is big, suppose there are 10 to the 60 Jovians compared to us, this is effectively 0. It's negligible, and all you end up with is the first one, the probability that basically there were no Jovians. And the trouble with this is that theories that predict atypical humans, in other words, lots of Jovians, are disfavored. In other words, you think you've shown the humans are typical, but in fact, all you've done is introduce a prior theoretical prejudice that there are not any Jovians, a prior theoretical prejudice that you're not a Boltzmann brain. This is called the selection fallacy and leads to a Copernican conundrum. The Copernican fans say, let's test all theories using all possible data and reason as though we are randomly selected bio-observer in the multiverse, but as Hartle and Srednickier point out, you run into a selection fallacy. But they would say, let's test our theories using our data, in which case you would find, because there are so many Jovians, that humans are atypical. It's pretty hard to have it both ways. All right, theology of the multiverse. I got less than 5 left. The main question it introduces is, rather than why is there something instead of nothing, why is there something instead of everything? And so you run into all these questions about purpose, theodicy, love, justice, and what these mean in a multiverse. And I contend these are non-trivial theological questions. Good news, if you're a theologian, I guess it means you got it. There's lots more jobs. But there are jobs to be done. The usual creatio ex nihilo picture is God could have created lots of universes, but the idea is that there's one with some kind of ontological separation between creator and creation. God creates the universe for a purpose, Isaiah 45, verse 18. Look it up in the pew if you don't believe me. But in creatio ex omnia, God doesn't create one universe. God creates everything God can think of. What stops this? There's no telic selection. There's a one-to-one correspondence between God's thoughts and action. What's the point of this God? Is there an ontological argument for the existence of the multiverse relative to the existence of God? Now, string theorists, I think, want to have it both ways. There's lots of multiverse theories, one of which is string theory. And so the idea is God creates only that. That's the creation ex nihilo. But the trouble is string theory gives so many universes, you're basically back to the same problem again. So instead of creativity, I think we have chaos, whereas if you threw paint against the wall, well, you might, if you wait long enough, get Da Vinci's Last Supper, but is that creativity? You have a Christology conundrum. In our universe, Jesus died on the cross, but over here in a nearby universe, he rejects it. Is this consistent with the God Jesus told us about? This is also a problem if we ever meet space aliens, by the way, but that's another talk. So to summarize, is the atypicality of our biophilic universe telling us something? I don't want to say that there's only a multiverse. Jesus says, I'm the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father but by me. Jesus affirms a single universe. Or does he? In my Father's house there are many mansions. If it were not so, I would have told you. Maybe, maybe, maybe he's affirming a multiverse, but I remain skeptical otherwise. Thank you.